I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 5 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee. I'd just like to thank everyone for tuning in and being an encouraging audience over the last few years, and I'm sure you will enjoy this season as well. We'll take some deep musical dives together in the coming months, and I'm looking forward to sharing some of these conversations I've been having with some incredible musicians and music producers with you. We have a couple of continuing sponsors that help to bring you each episode this season. The first is Union Tube and Transistor, making incredible guitar effect pedals out of Vancouver, BC. My old pal Chris Young at Union has been laying stuff on me for years, starting with his prototype Buzz Bomb pedal about 15 years ago. Since then, he's become a leading light in boutique pedal manufacturers with an extensive line of pedals like the Moor pedal, the Lab compressor, and the Sone Bender that are constants in my recording world. Check out their line of pedals at uniontone.com. And the second sponsor for the season is Black Mountain Thumb Picks. I've been using these myself for several months, and I think they're great. Cole McBride, the owner, is trying to make everybody happy and now has medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz tipped, left-handed, and regular and extra tight spring tensions available. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. So even though I've been doing this podcast for about 5 years, my heart just isn't into hounding companies for advertising dollars. So as always, this show mostly relies on listener support to keep going. And thanks to everyone that has done that in the past, it's a huge help to know that there's people out there willing to kick in to make it all possible. So if you're interested in doing so, there's a few simple ways to help out. First of all, please just tell your music nerd pals about this show. Word of mouth is probably the best way to get the show heard more. If you're in a position to kick in a bit financially, you can make a one-time donation or join in on my Patreon account, which is a monthly donation billed directly to your credit card at any amount of your choice. You'll also get access through Patreon to some private videos and other stuff as I make it available. And the third way that you can help out is to buy a t-shirt or other swag as it comes available. You can have a look at those or make a donation or join the Patreon, all at the new website, which is www.makersandshakerspodcast.com. And please don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get them from. And while you're at it, folks, don't forget to have a listen to our offshoot show called One Life featuring Jim Burns. It's a fun concept podcast involving live improvised music and off-the-cuff storytelling. I think you might dig it. And finally, please follow the show on social media. I have links to Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook all on the website, as well as a YouTube link. And that YouTube channel actually is going to get a bit more action this year. In the past, I've just put up links to some live performances, but I will be starting a video series this year about music and recording that I think you might dig. So please subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. Links are all at the top of the page at www.makersandshakerspodcast.com and at my personal website, which is stevedawson.ca. So that's about it for the biz side of things. Let's get going. On to this week's show. Hey there, folks. Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 114 with my guest from Toronto, but originally from the surprising musical mecca of Hamilton, Ontario, Mr. Colin Cripps. I hope you're doing all right out there. What's going on these days? We have a few shows left before we wrap up season 5, and then we're going to take a bit of a break over the new year and prep and produce the episodes for season 6. So that's coming, and I don't know, that'll start probably in March, maybe April. We'll see how it goes. Things are getting busier, so I have to fit it in where I can, but that's the way it goes. I should mention that I'm going to be releasing 3 new albums next year, starting in March, and while they're finished, I don't really have enough dough to print all the vinyl for them. So I started a Kickstarter campaign to basically pre-sell the vinyl. Now, if you're hearing this show on the day it comes out, there's still one more day to pre-order some vinyl or some CDs from my website. Well, actually, from the Kickstarter website. Just head over to my site at stevedawson.ca, and there's a link to the pre-order on the front page that takes you to Kickstarter, and you can make a pledge there. If I don't meet the goal, I don't press vinyl. So if you're interested, you want some, we do have a little ways to go still, but it's close. So please check it out. If you're listening a couple days later, you already missed it. Too bad. Before we get going, I would also like to thank, we had one sponsor for the show this week. And again, thank you so much. Can't do it without you. Even as things are winding down, it still costs money to put this show together. And so thanks to Tom Hicks this week. All right then, today's guest. He's someone I've known of for a long time. I've not known him for a long time. I've actually never really met him in person before. Especially as a Canadian musician working in the roots and Americana world. His name is Colin Cripps, and Colin is a connoisseur of tone, a connoisseur of guitars, a connoisseur of amps, and all kinds of cool stuff. What can I say? He's got a vibe. Now, for me, growing up on the West Coast in Vancouver, I wasn't as embroiled in the Ontario music scene as I got to be later on, and I was a bit young to see it, but there was this massive musical renaissance that came popping out of Hamilton, Ontario, which is a city about 45 minutes outside of Toronto. And that happened in the early 80s and continued for quite a while into the 90s. Now it's still going, of course, and there's a lot of music there. And a lot of my friends from Toronto have moved to Hamilton recently because it's cheaper. Although, from what I hear, not a hell of a lot cheaper anymore. Anyway, I digress. Now, a lot of that renaissance had to do with the emergence of Daniel Lanois as a superstar producer from that town there. But less famously, slightly, there was a whole cast of characters that came out of the woodwork there. And per capita, a hell of a lot of great ones. Producers, engineers, players that are world class. Colin is one of those guys, although he's a little bit younger than some of the dudes in that early sort of Hamilton scene. Mark Howard, Bill Dillon, amazing guitar player. Malcolm Byrne, who I've had on the show, Daniel's brother Bob Lanois, they all became pretty well known in the record-making world. And Colin was around all of it, from hanging out as a youngster in guitar stores and setting them up with strings and guitars to playing in the band Crash Vegas that also featured Jocelyn Lanois, who's Daniel's sister. So Hamilton was a happening place. And weirdly, Brian Eno, I mean, not weirdly, but amazingly, I guess, Brian Eno ended up hanging out in Hamilton to work on some really groundbreaking recordings with the Lanois brothers. And the success of that collaboration, one of my favorite Eno records is Apollo. And that's the one that, or one of the ones that he did with Daniel there in Hamilton in the early 80s. The success of that collaboration with Eno led to, you know, them doing U2 and Bob Dylan and all kinds of crazy stuff. And it also led to a vibrant studio scene in Hamilton. And it also opened the doors to creative spaces and some attention from the whole worldwide community. And Colin got to see a lot of that firsthand. And I really wanted to hear about how that whole scene worked back in the day. And also about his studio in New Orleans, Lanois Studio, which is where Colin recorded his debut with his band Crash Vegas. So anyway, we're going to talk about all that stuff. And since those days, Colin's become one of the most respected sidemen in Canada, producing and playing on records for the legendary Blue Rodeo, as well as Jim Cuddy's solo projects. And his work with Kathleen Edwards really reached new heights of musicality and tone as he sculpted some beautiful records with her. He plays with incredible taste and touch, and every time I've seen him live with any of those projects, Blue Rodeo or Kathleen Edwards, he always stands out in the best possible way. He's not flashy, but subtle and doing things on the guitar that you can really only do by developing over a lifetime of experience playing with different artists. Colin's also a bit of a gear fiend and collects vintage guitars and amps. And also, somewhat famously to a very small set of amp nerds, he also possesses the original Filmosound amp made by the mysterious Bernie. And that amp has gone on to inspire dozens of clones and attempts at copies, but he has the Ridge, and he knows all about it. So we had lots to talk about, and because of that, this episode is kind of long, and it gets split into two parts, and the second part will come out a week from today. Colin has a website, but it doesn't seem to be super active, but he's pretty active on Instagram, so you can follow him there, or on his website, colincripps.com, could be .ca, I can't remember. Anyway, without further ado, enjoy my part one of my conversation with Colin Cripps. So you live in Toronto now. Originally, you're a Hamilton native, and I wonder if maybe we should dive in and just talk about the Hamilton scene a little bit. Both, like, you know, you coming up as a youngster, you know, getting into music and playing in bands and stuff, and eventually Crash Vegas. But, you know, like, how it's changed is really interesting to me. But also particularly, like, the crew of musicians that came in. Like in your age group, but then also the older guys that are older than you, like Daniel Lanois and Bill Dylan and all those kind of guys. It's pretty remarkable. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about the scene going on there in Hamilton.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like I was fortunate enough to be right sort of in the right in the epicenter of time-wise of a lot of things converging in that. Yeah, sure.
Why don't you first tell me about just like, you know, growing up there, like. I know Hamilton, obviously. I've spent time there. I've done gigs there, and I've stayed there, and I've made a couple records there, actually. But as far as what kind of a town it was, it's close to Toronto, but it's far enough away to feel like a totally separate city. And just sort of what was going on for you and what kind of music you were into as a kid.
Well, you know, everybody sort of sees, and rightfully so, they see Hamilton as this kind of gritty steel town. Very working class, very very much based around you know, the factories there, the steel companies, and other various factories. It was a real factory town. Mm-hmm. So when I was growing up there, I lived in a couple different parts of the city, and I lived in a part of the city is called the North End, which is pretty much it was two things. It was pretty much the melting pot of all these ethnicities that had come from all over the place, you know, all different mm-hmm. parts of the world. To have a better life, let's say, after the Second World War. So by the 50s and 60s, you know, and into the 70s when I was a kid, you know, all my friends were in my neighborhood were all from different, you know, ethnicities. They were, you know, pretty much everything. And so musically, when I was first, you know, sort of, you know, when I was first connected with anything, it was through, you know, a bunch of kids around my neighborhood. And, you know, my first band was actually like a Ukrainian wedding band, you know, just because my friend played keyboards and, you know, and he had like a Moog, a mini Moog, but he also played accordion because it was, you know, it was like, so my first band was literally playing with, you know, in a Ukrainian wedding band. And
played Ukrainian weddings.
Yeah. Yeah. And okay. we would play Ukrainian songs, which I didn't know any of them. I would just learn stuff. Yeah. And then from there, you go on to, you know, we do some like rock covers and stuff like that. But the real thing about Hamilton was that it always felt like a working class environment. And I think musically, to speak musically about it, I always was surrounded by people who listened to music in a different way than white collar people would listen to music. You know, it was, mm-hmm. it was grittier. It came out of the bars, you know, it was driven by the bar scene and the clubs, you know, like the Legions and the, so my early days, especially for a long time, actually, my early days were, you know, surrounded by playing in or with guys who had made their living in bars and clubs around Hamilton. And the other big thing that happened for me was that I started working in a music store in Hamilton when I was 14. And that was truly my best sort of like education and meeting all different kinds of musicians and being like a sponge to soak up all of this. I was obsessed with guitar, but I didn't really know how to play it. You know, that, you know, it took time to learn, but I was lucky enough to get this job.
Is that when you started when you were about 14?
14. Yeah. Yeah. I started working, you know, in the store and then I saved up to buy, you know, I bought a Telecaster copy from them and made payments. And then I literally got a part-time job to pay it off. And I ended up working there for almost 9 years off and on. And
So
in those years, you know, they were sort of like this between 1976 and 1985, I guess you would say, I was like completely, you know, central to all this stuff that was going on in Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And then and I was also learning how to play. And so I was influenced by all the guys who would come in. Some guys were country guys. Some guys were rock guys. Some guys were...
These are like working musicians.
Yeah,
playing.
That was the nature of where music was in Hamilton. Like it really was a great place to play because you're playing bars, you know?
Right.
There were 20 bars in the vicinity that you would play. And they were circuit bars where you'd play 3 or 6 nights.
Yeah.
And, you know, the classic, you know, 3 to 4 sets a night. And so I met all these musicians, guys who were starting out then too, guys who went on to become notable and have had great careers. But that, you know, I was a, you know, 16-year-old kid meeting some of these guys who, as you mentioned, you know, they were from the 10 years before me. Mm-hmm. So when I met them, I was 16 and they're in their mid 20s. Well, now they're still playing in a relatively, you know, sort of young situations So that's really what Hamilton represented for me when I started, you know, and okay. I was just fortunate because I was able to kind of, you know, I was able to meet a lot of guys through the store, and then those associations brought me to different styles of music, and mm-hmm. some guys would come in, and then there was another thing that, you know, like my store, our store was, you know, the one example was our store was right downtown, so Hamilton Place, which was the kind of the main, you know, the main theater there. In the 70s and early 80s, Hamilton Place, you know, all the touring bands that would come through Hamilton, you know, the guy might need guitar strings or something like that. So they would come into the store. And I remember, you know, I met sort of touring musicians from the US and from Europe who were playing at Hamilton Place, and they just started wanting to kill an hour. So they come in the store and a few of those guys, they ended up every time they came to play to Hamilton, they would come and see me in the store. And so I made some, you know, early friendships from that.
Right. Right. Were you taking lessons at that time, or were you just sort of more soaking up music?
Just self-taught. Yeah. Just, you know, watching other guys and you know, doing what people do, listen to records and
yeah.
over and over and figure out the chord positions and the voicings and, you know, just kind of chip away.
Were you selling stuff at the store, or were you learning how to set guitars up and do
all that
kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I learned I started in the basement, sweeping the floor basically, and worked my way up. That's how I worked my way upstairs.
Classic.
But yes, I did all of that. And I loved it. I still love all that stuff, Steve. You know, I don't know why. It just was just something I loved early on. But I would sort of set up guitars. You know, I basically ran, by the time I was 17 there, I was running the guitar department. And I would, you know, so whatever inventory came in, I would, you know, take them out of the boxes. I would set them up. I would make sure they were ready to go on to the racks and stuff. And, you know, I was taking stuff apart. Just that seemed to be something I still like to do. So, so it was all very, very much part of that time at that store. I was really, you know, really deep seas for me.
Right. The Hamilton group of people that's like, you know, gone on to make such a big impact on the world, like, you know, famously Daniel Lanois, but also his brother Bob was a big part of what was going on at that Grant Avenue studio.
Yep.
And the guy that a lot of people don't know of, Bill Dylan, who I think is one of the great guitar players that came out of that. He's older than you, I guess. I don't know exactly how old you are, but
yeah,
I know those guys are like a good 10, 15 years older than you probably, right?
I would say Bill is 9 years older than me.
Okay. So yeah. were they guys that you were aware of in town?
Yeah.
Okay. And so what was what was their stature? Because a lot of they stayed in Hamilton for a while.
Well, you know, yes. And here's what I could say about the, you know, if there's a chronology to the, how things evolved, I would say that there's a, to the uninformed, but know the names, but don't know how they're all connected. Essentially what happened was, as you mentioned, you know, Daniel Lanois and his brother Bob, who was Danny Lanois, you know, back then, was they ran a studio in Hamilton called Grand Avenue Studios. They started it, and it was an old house. Basically, they converted to a studio that was just sort of, you know, about 10 minutes from downtown. And
I thought it was their like childhood house. So it was
no,
a separate...
they actually okay. Well, they came from Quebec when they were early teens. Okay. You know, the mother resettled in Ancaster, Ontario, which is basically just up the hill from Hamilton, and they settled there. And she was a hairdresser, so she basically rented a they had a house up in Ancaster. She used to do hair in the basement. And then Bob and Dan set up the very first studio they set up was in the basement of the house in Ancaster.
Okay.
And they were just doing like, you know, basic recordings and then they moved down to Grand Avenue and they basically converted a sort of this Victorian house, mm-hmm. small Victorian house into a full recording studio.
Yeah.
And they would, anything and everything came in through the door. You know, they did children's records. They did
a lot of children's records.
Yeah. They did Raffi records and Dan produced, and they would do whatever came in the door. They had a group of house musicians. I'd say Dan would call, say, oh, you know, I need this guy to play drums. And, you know, he had a stable of guys. And one of those guys was Bill Dylan.
Okay.
Bill was kind of like, you know, Bill was one of the recognized great guitar players in Hamilton for sure. And he was, you know, he had done some touring, I guess, with some, again, with like most guys back then played in cover bands, or if they were in original bands, it was a rare thing. Cause you really,
right.
You know, how many people do you know that had record deals in 1970, you know, 7, 78 in Canada? It wasn't as common.
And you could make a half decent living being a bar musician.
Yes. Yeah. So they were, you know, so that's exactly why, you know, a lot of these great players played in bar bands, because they were 6-night gigs. There was, you know, 100 bars in Ontario. You could play a circuit over a year. I mean, it wasn't the best environment necessarily, but you could make a pretty good living. So anyways, Bill was one of those guys. And so he used to get used on a lot of the stuff that Dan needed, like, you know, come in, I'm doing a 30-second commercial spot, and I needed, you know, I'll play some guitar, but I want your guitar, because Bill was really versatile even then. You know, Bill could play a bit of pedal steel, Bill could play, he could play mandolin, and, you know, he was just a good enough broad palette player, and he was a great guitar player. So
and was Dan at that point, was he considered a happening guitar player, or was that something that developed later?
Okay. Well, Dan was in a few bands in the 70s, especially, like, I remember him in one band when I was a kid, which was that he played with this guy named Ray Materek. And Ray Materek was a guy who was kind of in the mid to late 70s, you know, when the sort of coffee house folk singer boom had already happened in America, let's say between the early to mid 70s, you know, you had guys like Don McLean and all these narrative singer songwriters that were kind of an outstretch of Dylan and like, were, you know, John Prine. And so there was, you know, there was interest for sure in that. And this one guy, Ray Materek, who was a good songwriter, and he wrote a couple hits. One of them's called Linda Put the Coffee On.
nice.
And so it was like a Canadian AM radio hit. Well, his guitar player was Danny Lanois, right? And so Dan was definitely recognized as a player for sure. There's actually videos of him from the, you know, late 70s playing it with Ray Materek. I think his main focus then became the studio, and then all the, he definitely was, you know, you can see that he was moving towards a production career and having a studio life and all of the things that went with that, and not being a touring musician, let's say.
Right.
So Bill's part of his stable, and there was a few other guys that were part of, I think, Dan's stable and Bob, and that sort of fostered this work, you know, in Hamilton. Well, obviously, when Dan blew up in success, like fame, which came about 1985.
Yeah.
But he started working with Brian Eno, I think, in 1982.
In Hamilton, right?
At Grand Avenue. Crazy. And the story I was always told was that basically Dan was doing a lot of different types of records. He produced literally like Raffi and the Spoons and Martha
and the Muffins.
And he had done a record with these two women who probably 1981, 1982, kind of new wave. And he also did Martha and the Muffins. So he got his name on the map with Martha and the Muffins and then Parachute Club. So he was starting to
Parachute Club.
He had a role going where he was like certainly getting recognized as a Canadian record producer. But he did this record with these two really, I'm just trying to remember their name. It may come to me. That record got in the hands of Brian Eno. And he's like, who is this guy? Where is this place? I want to meet him.
He apparently
was looking for a place to sort of hide out too. He just wanted to go somewhere where nobody knew who he was, and he could just be kind of reinvent himself and be in this creative space where he literally could walk down the street and it would be like Hamilton's perfect for that.
Hamilton, Ontario.
Nobody cares who you are. So he ends up hearing about this record. Then he goes to Hamilton, meets Dan. They start this record series called the Ambient Series, which, put out in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And I have a few of them. I think there's four of them, but I have two of the four. And there's this beautiful experimental ambient style.
I love those records.
Instrumental records. Yeah. So that kind of was that sort of set the precedent for their relationship and Brian's the international star. Dan's the creative, young creative genius who's now got a springboard to the world, so to speak, through Brian. And then, of course, when U2 asks Brian to produce their record, which became the Unforgettable Fire, and Dan became part of that team, and then obviously superseded in some ways Brian's role and went on. So by 85, it all just blows up, right? So then the next record I think that Dan did was Robbie Robertson's first solo record. In 86. So when he put the band together for Robbie, he brought Bill Dylan.
Right.
And that's how Bill got springboarded into that greater, the greater realm of recognition. And then Dan's the catalyst to all these guys. And Dan brought another guy is Dave Bottrell. I don't know if you know Dave Bottrell. Yeah. Dave Bottrell was brought in because he was an assistant at Grand Avenue. And when Dan started working with Peter Gabriel in 1987, he said, well, I got this kid, this brilliant kid. I can bring him over to Real World and he can be help on the record. And that's how
amazing
Dave Bottrell got. So I think, if you were to take all the people that you and I might know in that Hamilton, from my generation, from my period, mid 70s to say mid 80s.
Yep.
All those guys are essentially springboarded through Dan.
Right. And was Mark Howard and Malcolm Byrne, were they also Hamilton guys?
Yeah. Well, wow. Yes. And Mark Howard was a Hamilton guy, is a Hamilton guy. He was from there. I think he was born in England, but his family came to Canada when he was a kid.
Okay.
But I knew Mark when he was like 17, 18, and he was literally, again, he was one of Dan's, he started out as one of take those speakers and haul them over there and lift them up that stairs and stuff. He was basically
a flunky studio. He was
a studio flunky. And then, Malcolm, same thing. Well, Malcolm had some success as a singer songwriter with this band called Boys Brigade. He was born in Blind River, Ontario. Which I don't know if you know about Blind River, but Blind River is this really strange place in northern Ontario. That's essentially like it's the epicenter of science, technology, and research. One of the places in the world where where nuclear scientists and very highly academic people go to work on to do research for. Government projects and stuff. So Malcolm's father was one of those guys.
Okay.
Malcolm grew up in Blind River. Then he moves to Toronto to become a musician. After he does Boys Brigade, he meets Dan, who by then is like everybody wants to meet Dan. Mm-hmm. And he wants to get into making records. And he was dating Dan's sister, Jocelyn. So moves to Hamilton. I worked with Malcolm really early on in him getting to Hamilton because Dan set up a small studio that we called The Lab, which was this really small little industrial space that, so this would be about 1986, 87 now. So Dan's already famous. And he set up this place just to be as a workspace for musicians to come and play, work on songs, and basically Malcolm ran it. You know, it was a little eight-track studer. So we had like an eight-track studer deck.
This is like another house in Hamilton, or what is it?
It was like an industrial space that was just a warehouse space, but you know, completely vibed it out and converted it into this studio space. And subsequently a lot of people worked there too, but because Dan put in great gear. He put in a beautiful eight track studer and a BCM 10, a Neve BCM 10. So everything was really high quality, level. But very simple. Like here's eight channels. If you can't make this work, you don't have anything, you know?
Yeah.
Whole thing was like, make this work and then we'll see, you know. So yeah, so Malcolm started there, and we used to go in and do stuff all the time.
What were you doing musically at that time? What was your situation?
Well, I had bands. I had been in, you know, I'd always had bands doing different things. I sort of recorded things here and there, but I was also still going to university. So then by the time I got out of university, I was sort of like full steam ahead. I wanted to try and give it as much of a chance to see if anything was going to happen. So I had songs that I'd been writing, and I had a couple of different bands with some people that eventually went on to do things as well in Hamilton, and Tom Wilson being one of them. And then my friend Dan Aiken. And so I was basically just trying to figure stuff out. I had done a stint in 86. No, it was 86 and 87. I had done it like an 11-month. When I finished university, I got offered my sort of first professional gig. I was a sideman in the Spoons for about 11 months.
Okay.
And they were popular, and so it was a gig, and I was like, okay, well, this isn't entirely what I want to do musically, but it was a step in getting somewhere, you know, into seeing if I had the goods to be able to, and if I really wanted to do it. So I spent 11 months on the road, and, you know, toured all over the US and Canada and with them. And I made some good friends from that.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The drummer in that band was Steve Kendry, who was a phenomenal drummer. So, you know, they had good players in their band.
That helps.
Yeah. So I did that for 11 months. And then after that, I started working with Malcolm, and we just sort of like, we do stuff at the lab, and that kind of, obviously I established a relationship with Jocelyn Lanois, Dan's sister, Malcolm and her were a couple.
Okay.
And then Jocelyn's the one that brought me to Crash Vegas, which was the first.
So she already had Crash Vegas going at that time.
Well, Crash Vegas was kind of like this seed. It had been sort of started for a few months, you know, and it was based in Toronto. So, and she lived in Hamilton, but based in Toronto. So at the time that I came in, you know, there was like five songs on the docket, and you know, it was a seed, you know.
And Greg Keeler was in the band at that time, right?
And Greg was in the band, yeah. So when the band, so what happened was they had like five songs, and Jocelyn said, well, you know, I'm in this new band and we want a guitar player, another guitar player. So will you come in and audition? Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, sure. So I went, you know, came to Toronto, and I came in with, well, they'd sent me a cassette tape of like three songs so I could just prep some parts, you know, just like, yep, you know, see what you come up with kind of thing. So I did that. And then I came in, and it was Greg and Michelle McAdory, Greg Keeler, Michelle McAdory, and then, and Jocelyn, and then this drummer, Ambrose. I came in and, you know, they just started playing the song, and I brought in the two things that Greg to this day will say, like, you know, it was sealed the deal for me even before I played a note, was I, cause at that point I was also a vintage junkie right from day one. So I always had good gear. I always looked for good stuff. And I came in with, I had a 65 AC30, Vox AC30.
Nice.
I had, a 67 Ricky 12, 360 12, which I still have, and a 58 Strat, just for the audition, right? And then the first song we did was like, I decided I'd come up with this whole 12 string guitar part. Well, I got four notes, you know, four bars into the song, and I look over at Greg, and he's just like beaming ear to ear. So I knew I had the gig,
right?
And that ended up being the start of my relationship with Greg, right?
Okay.
And
which has continued to this day.
This day, yeah.
Okay, so I do want to talk about the whole vintage guitar thing, but
sure.
let's just keep talking about Crash Vegas for a minute. So at what point did you guys sign your record deal? Like the first record you actually did down in New Orleans at Lanois Place, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about that experience? I'm fascinated with that place. You know, like obviously it holds, sure, sort of some mythological importance to me as a,
yeah,
Canadian musician.
Absolutely. To many of us. Yeah. Well, so then again, you know, I mean, it's like, it's incredible how my, you know, there's this serendipitous line to what I feel my career, maybe everybody feels that about their careers, but so that, you know, that serendipity of having connection to Greg and I and the band at the time, and
yeah,
Joss, obviously everybody that was, you know, we got signed pretty much within about 6 months of our starting to write material together as a group. And we started doing some shows here and there, because at that point, obviously, like Blue Rodeo was starting to, you know, get some ground for sure. Like their,
yeah,
the, you know, Outskirts had been out for well over a year, and they were playing bigger clubs and a few theaters here and there. So we would open shows for them. And then we ended up getting the same manager.
Keeler was gone from Crash Vegas at this point.
No, he was playing with both bands.
Oh, okay.
First year, he basically, it was him and I playing guitar. And then, yeah, so if we played a rodeo show, he'd play with us, and then he would do,
okay,
you know, their show.
Double
so,
duty.
Yeah. And so that carried on for about a year. Then we got a record deal with Warner Music in Canada, which was also Blue Rodeo's label.
So was Crash Vegas like busily touring the country, or were you not really that kind of a band?
Not until our first record came out. So everything,
okay,
I would say in relative terms, everything happened fairly quick in that we got our deal. You know, I joined the band in mid 87. We had a record deal by mid 88. We were in, we started making our record in early 89. At the lab, we started there actually with Malcolm, because the idea was that we didn't have a record producer, but we had these songs. And at that point, Malcolm had already moved to New Orleans to work with Dan as a more full-time assistant.
Yeah.
And he'd help Dan make two brilliant records. He'd help Dan make Time Out of Mind.
Oh Mercy, I think, right?
Oh Mercy, sorry, the first,
yeah,
one. He made Oh Mercy with him and this Neville Brothers record called Yellow Moon.
Yeah.
And, you know, within a year and a half of going to New Orleans. So he's well entrenched in New Orleans now, Malcolm. And so we're now ready to make a record. He agreed to come up and, say, spend a week working on seeing what we got. And then he would decide whether he was going to produce the record. So he was definitely on a big role. Malcolm,
yep,
again, through the work with Dan. And I mean, he was also a very talented guy. And so we ended up doing some stuff at the lab, and that turned into getting getting the record started. And then we were the first band to record at Kingsway in New Orleans. So Dan had bought this basically a 10,000 square foot mansion in the French Quarter at Esplanade and Charters. Mm-hmm. It's right on the corner. If anybody ever goes,
I've seen it.
Esplanade and Charters. That's Dan's Kings. That was Kingsway, and we literally were there. The paint was still drying. So this was August of 1989.
Okay.
And we were the first band to record there. And Mark Howard had now become the house assistant engineer. So Dan had brought him down from Hamilton after having been kind of the studio grunt in Toronto and Hamilton. And then he actually worked on Oh Mercy as well. And so that's how the Canadian contingent ended up in New Orleans.
So that studio then, so it was a mansion, but like, was it fully wired and stuff? Or did they just have like, was it wire cables running everywhere? And
Like, Steve, you've been there in August of 89, you know, it was well planned out, you know, like there's always a methodology to Dan's setting things up. And obviously by that point, he'd done quite a bit of it. He'd already done, you know, he'd done it with U2. He'd done it with Dylan. He'd done it with Neville Brothers, he'd done it with all these others. So you could basically park a console in a living room,
right,
run the cables wherever, you know, they would still always add vibe. It wasn't like there wasn't a sense of importance to the vibe. That was always, mm-hmm. always there. You know, they would hang curtains in certain places just so that people felt that they were in a space. Mm-hmm. That they could be more creative. Or so Kingsway was like probably the perfect place for that.
Right.
Because each room was all the big rooms. You know, the dining room was this beautiful room, and that became the console room, you know, the control room. There was no isolation. You know, they go like the hallway was right beside, like, you know, if you turned around, the hallway was there. And then the room across from there was like an instrument room, and we could record anything in there. You record mm-hmm. in the hallway, record on the stairs.
How long did you guys spend there on that record?
Well, we started in Hamilton. So by the time we got there, I was there for 3.5 months.
Holy shit.
When making a record, it's so great. Making a record was like, you know, you're going to make your record in, you'll get, you know, 3 months. And everybody's like, okay, well, that seems normal, right? We'll record a song a day, you know, work 4 days a week, maybe take weekends off, be, you know, let the spirit, you know, come to you. Maybe you'll write a song or two down here. And I mean, the way making records then, does it seem indulgent in today's sort of perspective? Maybe everybody thinks that, you know, like it's a waste. I mean, I've made records certainly in that context where it was definitely a waste of time. You could have done the record a third the amount of time.
Yeah.
But indulged by the process, or in the case of having a certain producers, you know, that's just what you would, that's what you would have to accept, right?
Were you guys given a sizable budget for your debut record, or was it just sort of all done on a shoestring and you just managed to stretch it out to 3.5 months?
For the time, yeah, I'd say we got a pretty decent budget for Canadian first, you know, first record.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they gave us, but this may have included the first video, because remember back then videos were a huge component to the formula, right? You make your record for, and then, you know, so you had to sort of budget all out. So
and that shit's expensive too when you do it up.
Even then they were, you know, like you're throwing, I think they were 30 grand for a video. And then, so I think our budget was $80,000 for the first video and the record, which today is like, you know, I mean, you know, you and I make records for a third that amount, I'm sure.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, and that's the norm today, right?
Yeah.
Though I don't like it, but that is the norm. But at that, back then, 80 grand would have been a respectable budget for a Canadian budget. And we spent 3.5 months in New Orleans. You know, I lived there. I got to, you know, I was just, and that studio, you know, I subsequently, you know, as it became kind of one of the go-to places in the world, I used to go back there, you know, especially, well, Bill moved to New Orleans at one point, and I used to go
visit him. Okay.
Yeah, he moved to New Orleans in the early 90s. And so I used to go to visit him. You know, he lived around the corner from Kingsway and on Royal Street. And I used to go and I'd go down there and spend a week and hang out. And my, you know, at one point, my girlfriend at the time was the studio manager at Kingsway. And,
okay.
You know, so I did get to spend time there over the years that it evolved from being that very beginning, you know, idea to this sort of, as you know, I think a lot of people who knew it is like this sort of legendary studio, right? Mm-hmm.
So did you, like, as a musician, as a guitar player specifically, with that experience of being able to spend that kind of time on a record, were those early experiences for you instrumental in, you know, developing the way that you approach playing on a record? And were you given the freedom to experiment with sounds and textures and stuff like that?
I would say Malcolm was really influential to me that way. And okay. Bill was too, from a player's approach. Cause Bill kind of became my mentor after I met Bill formally about 1987. And so by that point he had a name, you know, he'd done Robbie's record. He's working with, and then funny enough, you know, Bill ended up moving into my house in the late, around 1990. And we lived together for 2 years in Hamilton. So I have a long, long history with Bill and a lot of, but he being, you know, almost 10 years older, he was a real mentor to me. Like I watched how he played. I learned so many techniques from him about how to approach guitar as a voice, not just like you're the guitar player. And that really stuck with me. It still does. It's still part of the fabric of how I think about the instrument, you know, the possibilities where they're appropriate, right? Mm-hmm. And he was a big influence on that. So by the time I got to New Orleans, you know, that and Malcolm having that sensibility too, it was always about performance and does it speak in a way that represents the song and your personality? You know, those things were really important. It wasn't just about, okay, get those licks perfect. Right. It's, you know, it was all those things that matter to making people feel something. So,
and it seems to me like your vibe too, you were as much influenced by, like, you know, guitar players, but also, you know, more of the textural guys like The Edge, I know, was an influence for you, and Johnny Marr probably, and guys like that were doing stuff that wasn't like lick-based guitar playing.
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up with that because I think we all started, especially if you're my age, you know, we all started listening to our heroes, you know, and you were like, okay, there's the classic five British guys, and then there's, you know, there's guys, American players, and then then there's the sort of the outliers that you discover. You know, I listened to everybody I thought might be worthy of some kind of education, really, as much as inspiration for me. So I definitely, by that point, especially being around guys like Bill, you know, I realized that I didn't want to just, like, I never was going to be the best. You know, I loved tally players. You know, I love those players. And I especially like, I mean, I love Roy Buchanan was like one of my heroes when I was 17. I love that style of playing and I love the sound. But I realized like I'm never going to be that great at that style because I'm distracted by other things too. You know, it's like I do love ambient style guitar players and don't have to be technically the best sort of.
Who are your favorites that would fall under that category?
Well, I would say from probably the period that I was, like, say, early to late 80s, it would definitely have been The Edge. I saw U2 the first time we played in Toronto. I was 20 years old. They were a buzz band. You know, it was like there were like 500 people. And to this day, that the simplicity of their gig and nothing. It was just the four guys. And his guitar tone and what he was doing just... I was just like, I'd never heard anybody do it that way. You know, it wasn't that it was difficult per se, but the voicing and the signature was undeniable. And he was 20 years old. So, and I was 20 years old. So for me, that was like a real, like that was a real thing. It wasn't just because I, you know, I could listen to other guitar players who were older than me, you know, guys who were legendary players, Les Pauls, all these guys were, you know, they were in their 40s and 50s at that point, you know, so you're listening to guys that have been from a different generation of players and that.
Yeah.
This guy was my age. And I'm like, how the is he doing that? How did he come up with that way to do it and make it sound dimensional because he's the only guitar player? And that was also a big part for me too. I felt like I wanted to feel, and again, like the guys that I luckily, when I met Bill, for example, he was that kind of player too. Whereas like you did, you could play more dimensionally with the guitar and you could sort of, you could extract a bigger palette of sound out of basic chords or basic, you know, voicings. And I, and then Johnny Marr did the same thing for me. You know, Johnny Marr's a, you know, he was the classic arpeggiated style player, you know, but he's just basically, not basically, but he's cleverly taking inversions and chord voicings and he's tying them all together into these musical parts and doing it so well that it became a stylistic approach, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I absolutely, I was influenced by those guys in that way. But I also still loved Cliff Gallup and Roy Buchanan. And I still love the sort of classic, you know, Jimmy Bryant, you know, like guys who were so, you know, at such a level of playing that I still pull, I'm always try to pull that stuff in. That was definitely, I mean, I'd say in a nutshell, that is definitely part of the mutation of my influence and my style and how I wanted to approach the instrument in songs or in recording.
And did you develop any sort of techniques for recording electric guitars early on that have stuck with you that would be unusual? Or was that, was the process for you guys at that stage more just like stick a mic in front of it and get the interesting stuff coming out of your fingers and the instrument?
Well, you know, it's good that you asked that because I didn't know anything. You know, I was green as it gets. I hadn't done a lot of recording. And if I had, it was always just like, I was so worried about doing, not screwing up the recording. I didn't pay attention to the logistics, you know, but I was fortunate. I can tell you this honest to God story. One time I was, you know, I was at Kingsway and Dan came and I was recording electric guitar on something. And I had been using AC30s pretty much by that point, you know, that I established that was the sound I really gravitated to. And I had been working with that tone and I, you know, of course Dan comes to visit and hang out and I go, Dan, you know, we're doing some guitars. And he said, can, you know, and I would never ask him anything. Cause it was just, you know, it's just sort of like, I just didn't feel like I wanted to be imposing that way, but that one day I did. I said, Dan, you know, can I just, you know, because you know, I never really told him that necessarily. Edge was one of my heroes back then, and I said, but just, I said, like the sounds you get on out of the AC30. I just kept it on the AC30.
Right.
The sound you get out of the AC30. Is there anything I should know? And I swear to God, Steve, he goes, this is what you got to do. And he goes over to the amp and he goes, you got to turn it up. You just got to turn it up. And then he says, and then the rest is all in your hands. Yeah. So I realized like there are certain, and this is a whole other thing, but to hopefully answer the question, it was, okay, the amp runs hot. That's always the thing.
Yeah.
Run it at the sweet spot. Right. That's what I call it, the sweet spot. Run the amp at the sweet spot and then figure out how to back it off tonally or dynamically in the way that you either with the guitar volume or your hands, your, you know, that was the, you know, that was the day that I've never forgotten that. I went,
that's
always
cool, man.
Amp hot.
Yeah.
Now with AC30s, it's a bit of a trouble. It's a hard thing to do.
That's a loud ass amp.
It is a really loud amp. But the sound you get at two is like a nice sound. You know, it's like, okay, you can get a nice guitar track and maybe add a little bit of some treatment to it to bring it to a link. But it, you know, it's like every amp I own, you know, not to go off the topic, but pretty much every amp I own has a sweet spot. And if you hit it, if you put it at the sweet spot, everything just happens the more that you want it to. Mm-hmm. And then you just have to figure out how to, you know,
harness that,
or it's relative, you know, okay. Yeah. Every Fender amp sounds great at five, you know, they just, everything kicks in at five. So you run it, but you know, so then maybe you can't use a twin at five. So you use a Princeton Reverb, or you use, you know, a Champ, or and it just becomes a relative thing. Mm-hmm. Right. So I learned that lesson from that among many, but that's the one lesson I learned from Dan about how to approach recording guitars to tracks. And then I've never really changed from that, but I run the amps hot, and then I back everything to where the tone might make sense. You know, if it's mm-hmm. a clean sound or but there's always a relative strength coming out of the amp if I want it.
Where's a sweet spot on an AC30? Is it more like it's 6, like 1-7?
Yeah. So, well, an AC30, like zero, let's say that if you've got the old style ones, a zero is at like 6 o'clock, right?
Yeah.
Where the pointer's at the bottom at 6 o'clock. I say that's zero. And then you basically got to go to 12 o'clock. And then the sweet spot's around 1 o'clock, mm-hmm. maybe one, just a little past one. Some are a little, you know, if they're originals, you know, if the pots aren't changed, you know, but yeah. Basically on all my 30s, about 1 o'clock, okay. Just past 1 o'clock, and on a top boost channel, which is kind of the only channel that most guys use, the top boost channel in a classic AC30. And the one, you know, I was very fortunate years, about 10, 12 years ago. Well, maybe more now, but one of my good friends works for U2. And I finally got to stand right in front of Edge's original AC30 that he's had since 1978.
Wow.
It's the number one. It's been, you know, and it's literally the one he's had since day one. Or not day one, but that's his number one AC30. And I get to stand over it, and I looked at his settings and his volume. It's like 1 o'clock.
Oh, yeah. That's the spot.
I don't know. Have you used AC30s much?
You know, that's an amp that I just don't know at all. Like I've just, you know, just through, you know, gigging and touring and backlining, I always end up with Fenders, and around my place, I've got some Tweed and some Blackface Fenders, and I've just never, I like small amps, you know? Yeah. So an AC30 for me is just like, I wouldn't really know how to deal with it. I feel like.
Well, they are beasts, but you know, I can't use them any. I'm lucky now in Blue Rodeo that I'm still using my AC30, and my original, the one I've had since 88.
Okay.
I still use that, but everything's ISO'd now. So.
Oh, okay.
Right. So there's no stage volume. My cabinets, I have the speakers, you know, in ISO boxes, 20 feet off the stage. Right.
Because
we're on ears. So I can run the amp. I can run it at 1 o'clock for tone.
Okay.
And, but it's not, there's no volume. Yeah.
So does an AC15 follow suit in that way? Or does an AC15 not have that same mojo that
it does? It does have the same mojo. Funny enough, you know, I have an AC15. This just sounds phenomenal. And I use that I have this surf band that I use all the
with Champagne.
With Champagne James, yeah.
Yeah.
And that, all the recordings and is that AC50. It's a Tex made EF86 tribute to an AC15, but it's essentially an AC15. It's like, and so yes, I would say if you're, you know, just for your own interest, if you don't, you know, if you don't want to go AC30, like a quality done AC15 will get you there. Oh yeah. They're a little bit toppier because the old ones, the original, a lot of the good repros will have an EF86 as the first gain stage tube, which is a little bit bitier and zingier than say a 12AX7. So that tube, you know, it just gives you a little bit different top end, but still fantastic. Just fantastic.
So why would you still lean towards an AC30 if if volume is an issue, obviously in Blue Rodeo now, why not take an AC-15 out?
Well, I'm a diehard, right? I just like diehard, right? So because I have them and I know that those amps, I have two AC-30s that just sound phenomenal. So I'm very lucky that I can still use them. Mm-hmm. And volume's not an issue because it's all in ear. So for me, it's just about the tone. Like I know what those amps will do as far as the tone.
Yeah.
And but if at some point the transporting and all that stuff, you know, becomes an issue, then I probably would use the AC-15.
Okay.
It does get you there.
How's the effect for you, like as a hardcore guitar player that's played through, you know, nicely cranked AC-30s all your life, suddenly isolating that amp away from you and being on in-ears? How's that experience for you?
Oh, it's I've been doing it for 10 years now.
Yep.
And still struggle with it.
Yeah, I bet.
Because, you know, I mean, I don't know if your career has been a lot with in-ears, but I find most guitar players, like, I love it for vocals. I love it for timing. You know, mm-hmm. I love all of that stuff, you know. For guitar, I think for certain things it works well. You can find these comfort zones to play, but generally I find it really hard. I find it hard to solo with in-ears because it's too much proximity to my face.
Yeah.
We spent 35 years playing guitar, the amps over here, you know.
You feel it
all around you and you can feel it, but it's spatial too. And as soon as you take that sound and you put it like right here, you know, in your face, and it becomes more, I feel almost in a weird way, I feel more detached from it than connected to it.
Yeah.
So I tend to pull an ear a lot for solos when I play, because I need to hear it. And even though our monitor guy's trying to create it in my ears, you know, with room mics and stuff,
it just doesn't
do it. Right. So, so that's where I struggle to this day.
Greg Keeler has like serious hearing problem, right? Like, is that why you guys are so quiet on stage? Is that the issue, is that you just need to bring the volume down?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Like everybody's on in-ears except for him. He plays acoustic guitar now, basically. He doesn't play electric.
Yeah.
He plays acoustic, like a split DI to the house. And then he has like a Blackface Vibroverb that he uses, or Vibrolux, sorry, that he plays, like the acoustic goes through some pedals. So he can play kind of like, you know, vibey Greg parts that sound colored.
Okay.
For an amp, but he doesn't. Yeah. And, but the rest of us are on ears basically. Basil plays on a thumper, you know, what I call him.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So his volume, he's still playing SVTs, but his volume is very, very quiet. So the thumper kind of helps with the articulation. And, but yeah, that's the reason why it can happen. Cause otherwise the band probably wouldn't be able to play live the way that it certainly used to.
He's sort of at that stage where it's like painful. Is that where he's at?
It got to that stage. Yeah, he's managed it really well in the last, I'd say probably for the last 5 years, you know, he's been much, much better, but he pretty much is constantly wearing ear protection now. But I think that's like, he's much better than he was, but it's still, it's just what it will be from now on.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. That was part one of my conversation with Colin Cripps. We'll be back 1 week from today with part two. Tune in then. We'll talk to you later. See ya. Thanks for listening, everybody. The Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee at the Hen House Studio. Don't forget to follow us on social media and please subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify Podcasts. And you can find us online at makersandshakerspodcast.com. As always, thanks to Jeremy Holmes in Vancouver for help with research. And we'll see you next month for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. See you then.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.